From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, opposing your country's leader, but being terrified of the NATO bombing intended to punish him. We talk with Serbian novelist Jasmina Tešanović about her life just before and during the bombing of Serbia, and about life after the ouster of Milosevic. During the bombing, she emailed journal entries to a friend in Sweden. Those passages ended up on dozens of websites and were translated and emailed around the world. Now her journal is published in the new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot. Also, as the contested presidential election continues to play out in the courts, our linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on legalistic language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republican leaders of the Florida legislature have called a special session to name a slate of presidential electors committed to George W. Bush. Senate President John McCain and House Speaker Tom Feeney say they set the session for Friday, so lawmakers would have time to act in case the disputed election is still tied up in court on December 12th, the deadline for sending names to the Electoral College. Feeney said he still hopes the courts will resolve the issue by that time.
I believe deeply that we have a duty to protect Florida's participation in the Electoral College. And I have a hope, and I believe most of my colleagues in the House, that the electoral issues may be resolved without the necessary of the legislature taking final action.
Senate President McKay said the session is intended to protect Florida's 25 electoral votes and its 6 million voters. A federal appeals court in Atlanta decided against Governor Bush today. The Bush lawyers had asked the court to stop all recounts on the grounds that they were a violation of the guarantees for equal protection and due process for all voters. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports from Washington.
Today, by a vote of 8-4, the Court of Appeals in Atlanta rejected the Bush arguments. In an unsigned opinion, the majority said it's not necessary to conclude definitively right now that the Florida system is constitutional or unconstitutional, since the court said Governor Bush and his supporters have not shown they've suffered serious, much less any irreparable injury from the system. The court noted Governor Bush and Secretary Cheney have been certified the winners in Florida, and even if the recounts were to resume by order of the state courts, quote, it is wholly speculative as to whether the results of those recounts may eventually place Vice President Gore ahead in the vote. The federal court's ruling puts the focus back squarely on the Florida courts for now. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A Russian court convicted American Edmund Pope today on charges of buying secrets about a high-speed Russian torpedo. The court sentenced Pope to the maximum 20 years in prison. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Distraught, she waited in the corridor while her husband made his final appeal, telling the judge he's not a spy. Sherry Pope and a few journalists were allowed in the courtroom only when the verdict was announced. She held her husband's trembling hands as the judge read rapidly. The court-appointed interpreter translated very little, and Pope often shook his head in disbelief. Pope was told he has 7 days to appeal. The Clinton administration has called on Russia to release Pope on health grounds. He has bone cancer that was in remission. His wife fears his illness has returned. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 233 points, or 2.1%, to close at 10,665. This is NPR News. Texas officials have approved a plan to bring Houston into compliance with federal clean air standards. Houston is the nation's smoggiest city, in part because of emissions from its oil refineries and petrochemical plants. The cleanup plan includes reducing the speed limit to 55 miles per hour and lowering industrial emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency must sign off on the plan, which would keep Houston from losing federal highway money. Health officials say an E. coli outbreak in the Midwest has now been linked to illnesses in 29 people. Minnesota Public Radio's Tom Scheck reports.
Health officials say they've diagnosed 4 new cases in Minnesota and 3 in Wisconsin as a result of the outbreak. DNA tests are still being done in Illinois and Iowa to see if E. coli cases in those states are also linked to the outbreak. On Monday, a Wisconsin-based beef processor announced a 15-state recall of 1.1 million pounds of beef that was processed on November 2nd and 3rd. The U.S. Department of Agriculture requested the move, but some health officials say it isn't going far enough. A spokesman for Minnesota's health department says it's likely more people could get sick. The foodborne illness can be fatal for children, the elderly, and people with weak immune systems. For NPR News, I'm Tom Scheck in St. Paul, Minnesota.
The U.S. economy showed more signs of a slowdown in October and November. The Federal Reserve said its districts across the country reported slower economic growth with some tendency toward inflation, although prices of manufactured goods and services remained stable. The Fed's latest Beige Book report said most areas of the country reported labor shortages, but there are some signs that the job markets are easing. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When NATO started bombing Serbia last year, Jasmina Tešanović tried to stay sane by writing. She opposed the Milosevic regime, but she was terrified of the bombs. Tešanović is a novelist who lives in Belgrade. She also co-founded Serbia's first feminist press and edited a collection of essays by Croatian and Bosnian refugees. During the bombing, she emailed journal excerpts to a writer friend in Sweden. The friend posted the diary entries on the website of a magazine she wrote for. The journal was soon on 50 websites and emailed around the world. Now Tešanović's journals are published in the new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot. We invited her to talk about life just before and during the bombing and about life since Milosevic was overthrown. Let's start with a reading from a journal entry written before the NATO bombing when the Serbs were on the rampage in Kosovo.
March 20th, 98. It has been a terrible month. The killing has started again, this time in Kosovo. Once again, we are witnesses who cannot see. We know it is going on, but we are blind. It's not even the killing that makes me die every day, little by little. It's the indifference to killing that makes me feel as if nothing matters in my life. I belong to a country, to a language, to a culture which doesn't give a damn for anybody else and for whom nobody gives a damn. And I'm completely paralyzed. I'm not used to fighting. I'm not used to killing. I don't believe anybody anymore, not even myself. I have stayed here and I have made a mistake, victim or not. I have become one of those who did nothing for themselves or for those they love. I have a feeling that I will not survive.
That's Jasmina Tešanović reading from her new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot, Normal Life in Belgrade. Jasmina, why did you decide to stay in Belgrade knowing that the bombing was likely to begin?
I tried to get away in 1992 when first time we had a threat of bombing Belgrade. I went to Vienna with my family, with my daughter, and we stayed there for 3 months. I was so unhappy, you know, because worrying all the time for my friends, for my family who could make it. And as soon as the threat was gone, we went back, you know, to Belgrade. Then there was other threats in 95, in 97, I think, again. But, you know, in October, when we were quite sure that the bombings will come, I had this feeling that if I leave now, I will never be able to come back because somebody else will take over my country. I will have no place to come back, you know, either be it Milosevic, who will take over completely, either be it some troops, you know, occupied by the, you know, winners, whoever the winner is, I would lose my country. And then I felt a great solidarity with the people who couldn't make it, who couldn't leave for many reasons, you know. And actually, I could have left only with my daughter. That means leaving all my men behind. And, you know, men in this situation get depressed because they're mobilized. They have to kill and they have to be killed. And with my philosophy of being a woman, I thought that women can save men from being killed, at least their own men, and from killing, you know. And I was like glued to Belgrade.
Now, the impression I had trying to follow the story from here in the United States mm-hmm. was that most of the intellectuals and the writers and the dissidents had fled Serbia years ago, and that there was very few intellectuals and artists and dissidents left anymore. What was your impression of that?
No, you see, I don't believe in that kind of vision, and I fight strongly against it because I think nobody had a true option. You know, there were compulsive options, you know, and there is a division going on between those who left and those who stayed behind. Both of the sides consider themselves better off, you know. Those who left accuse of those who stayed behind, saying you're the traitors, you're the accomplices to the situation. Those who stayed behind accuse those who left, you left us, you abandoned us, you're the traitors, you know, especially now when the situation got better and everybody wants to stay in Belgrade, actually, and build their life anew, you know. But I always protest against these kind of divisions because those who left had to leave, you know. Nobody had a good choice, you know. And I think that the division line was really among those who could do it, who didn't have a family, who had the money, who had the opportunity to go somewhere, and those who didn't, you know. And that's how it should stay, you know.
No, when you know that the bombing was going to happen, some parents, like, sent their children to another country. You kept your daughter with you. Mm. How did you make that choice about what to do?
You see, I have stepsons, you know, and we tried to send away the older one who was actually supposed to be mobilized, you know. He was really running. He was a war deserter for 10 years. Only now he got his passport. And he went to Rome. I had friends in Rome. He even made it to enter a very good academy of arts, you know. He came back in 4 months because he had his girlfriend and his dog. You see, my children wouldn't have left in any way. My daughter, she's the youngest of all, you know, and she never wanted to leave the country because of her friends. It was a big solidarity going on among children, especially, and those children actually are the one who overthrew Milosevic at the very end. You know, they're part of the resistance of the strong movement. It's popular movement, but it was led by students and war children, and my children are part of that movement, you know.
Are you proud of your daughter for being a part of that?
Well, proud is something I was afraid all the time. Now that it's all over, I'm proud. Because, you know, during 5th of October, during the day of our revolution, the 3 hours we had the revolution, I was in front of the parliament. And when the gas came, I ran back home because it was suffocating.
Tear gas you're talking about?
Tear gas, oh, yes. And it was terrible. You know, I saw them enter the parliament. I thought, now it's over and I'll go back home. And my daughter phoned me. She was behind the parliament, in a much worse situation, with flames, parliament in flames, TV building in flames. And I said, oh, and she asked me, how are you? Are you okay? And I said, yes, I'm okay. And how are you? And she said, are you? Oh, don't bother, she said. And did the police beat you? I said, no. Did the police beat you? And she said, no, we are beating the police. And she's 16, you know. And I read it in the papers the next day that a group of school children were kicking out the police out of the police station. The first police station that was really freed was done by a group of elementary school children.
So tell me more about what your daughter did in that.
Well, you know, it is a big secret for me because even during the bombings, only now I found out that she was actually cruising every morning, you know, with her friends. It wasn't an isolated, she wasn't, you know, the different person from other children. She was every morning, she would say, can I go out a little bit? And I said, just a little bit, but when the alarm comes, you know, you must come back home. And she said, why? I said, because if the bomb hits, I want you to be with me. And she said, no, I want to die with my best friend. And I said, no, you will die with me. And we were like, you know, talking as if it was a matter of going to a discotheque and coming back home. You know, very strange, but it was normal. I mean, it's nothing special about that. And only now I learned that she would take a bus in the morning, because we had only a few buses during the bombings, and they would cruise around the hit targets, so they would look if there were dead bodies around, how did the buildings look, you know. Children take war in a different way.
You write about the divisions between families and between generations. Your parents were ardent communists, and they thought of you as a traitor for not being a communist and then for not supporting the Milosevic government. What were the divisions between you and your daughter politically?
I think there's a huge generational gap, you know. We never really spoke directly, not yet, no. I think we need some healing time in order to bring out all our true thoughts, you know. We're not being honest to each other. Because she was, all the time she was afraid for me, you know, because she knew the kind of stuff I was really doing, politically speaking. And she had this protective attitude, even ever since she was a kid, you know, she had this protective attitude towards me because she had this feeling that her mother is not protected enough from her parents, you know, from her grandparents, you know. I was like the crazy woman doing stuff that nobody was really doing, you know.
Like what?
Like, you know, political standings with women in black and being spits and, you know, and I, very often I would say to her, you know, if the police comes in, just don't worry, don't say anything. It's your country, it's your police. If they ask of me, you say, you don't know where's your mother. And she grew up this kind of, it's not that I was that important. You know, I wasn't that important politically speaking. I don't have a party, I don't have a paper. So, but it could have happened, you know, in a way. So she had this feeling of protecting me. And she also behaved as somebody who really doesn't want to take part in my public life because she said that it was too public, you know. And I can understand that, you know. But when what I found out later on in these last years, that she really wasn't that straight or not interested in what was going on as she behaved. You know, she had to do it, you know. I realized that she had a big political conscience. But the gap exists still between us because my conscience was from my mind. You know, it came from my intellectual, you know, activities. And she is just a body of war, you know. Her childhood was war. So it's a completely different conscience.
Right. You know, even before the bombing started, you write in your diary about how the fascism of the government seemed to be reflected on a more personal level, that the way people were acting in their own families seemed to be an extension of the political fascism, like your neighbor who beat his wife and pissed in the hallway. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about how you felt that fascism was being expressed in a more...
It always is that way, yeah. You know. It always is. You can always see the political patriarchal structure in a family, you know. You can see it on other social levels. For example, after Milosevic came in power, you would see little Miloseviches everywhere, you know. Not only in a family, you would see it like in a gas station, a person behaving and speaking like Milosevic, you know, because you do it, you know. People do it. They imitate a leader. You know, whoever he is, be it good leader, be it a bad leader, is some kind of social phenomenon, you know. And I think in every society, in any time, you know, we should fight against the vertical patriarchal structure in a family. It's grassroots politics. When you deal with that, you're kind of doing what you can do, you know. And then the rest comes on its own. If you deal with your neighbor beating his wife, you know, very soon you won't have this neighbor voting for Milosevic.
So what did you do about your neighbor who was being beaten? Did you feel there was anything you could do?
Of course, we did it. We went to the neighbor and we said, please don't do it. We tried to speak and we intervened. I intervened and I went all through my building trying to ask people to intervene too, and we stopped it, you know. You can do that kind of stuff.
My guest is Serbian novelist Jasmina Tešanović. Her journal of life just before and during the NATO bombing of Serbia is published in the new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jasmina Tešanović, and she kept a diary while Americans and NATO were bombing Serbia, where she lives. And that diary has just been published. It's called The Diary of a Political Idiot. She's a writer who has written several novels. She's also translated many books. And she's visiting the United States on the occasion of the publication of her book. It seems in some ways like the most difficult part for you during the bombing was just before the bombing actually happened, when you were waiting for it to start. My impression from your journal is that that's when your anxiety and your fear were at their peak.
Yeah, it was much easier when it started, you know. At least we had a feeling that now it started and it has an end, you know. And we're through with it, you know. Finally, we are paying the price and we have to pay it, but we'll be done with it for good, you know. And I always repeat this and I'll say it again. It wasn't the bombing that was that bad, you know. It was limited in time and space. It was precise targeted. I'm against bombings, of course, you know. But you had a lot of decent people in Belgrade who said, let us bomb us, let them bomb us, as long as it's over, because we cannot go on forever. Forever with what? With sanctions. The sanctions were the true killing machine, you know, in Serbia. You had people being killed because of lack of antibiotics. I saw it. I saw children dying, children who could have been cured. The same thing is going on in Cuba still, in Iraq. It was in South Africa. Sanctions are the killing machine. It's an invisible killer. You know, nobody has dirty hands in this kind of, and only common people are struck by sanctions.
Well, it's easy in the United States to feel that sanctions are a more peaceful way of pressuring a foreign government to stop its mistreatment of its own people or of the people of another country. You know, because you're not bombing them; it's just economic sanctions. So you're disagreeing with that?
Absolutely. I think bombing is not really a solution. I won't discuss that at all, you know. But I think sanctions, you know, it has to be revised. The way they're put, you know, the way they're implemented, it's completely working on the behalf of the you know, dictator in power, of the class in power.
Well, the way it's supposed to be working is that the people of Serbia say it's because of that Milosevic that we're suffering with these sanctions. Therefore, let's get rid of him.
No, it's not that way. It's completely the opposite. We are suffering because we are under sanctions. If we didn't have the sanctions, we would be very well off. That's
how
it works.
So you get angry at the United States, not at Milosevic during the sanctions?
Personally, I got angry at both, you know, but I think people can very easily get angry at not being able to have antibiotics and die, you know. They don't get angry with Milosevic. They get angry with whoever doesn't give them antibiotics, you know, so they die, you know.
Well, getting back to the anxiety that you felt before the bombing actually started, there's one moment you describe in your journal where you drank a lot, you took some drugs, and you started banging your head against the wall and concussed yourself.
Yeah, it was a terrible moment. I remember that night. I don't know how to explain it. I think it's a normal thing, you know, that happens to people who want to find a way out. They cannot find a way out. It's some kind of suicidal attempt, I think, I had, you know. But then, I know very well that I have a daughter, I have children, you know, I have parents, you know, and that I cannot afford a suicide, you know. So I think that was some kind of, imitation of a suicidal attempt. But it was very dramatic, you know. I remember it was very, this expectation of the tension was in the air, you know. Really, it was easier when the bombing started because, as I said, we're waiting for the end at that time, you know.
How did you feel the next morning after you'd given yourself a concussion?
Stupid, you know, stupid. But I was relieved that I'm alive, you know, that I didn't do something more drastic.
During that period when all these nightmare scenarios were going through your mind, what were the worst things, the things that you most wanted to avoid happening?
Personal violence. You know, I had this, you know, we all have interiorized pictures of previous wars, you know, Second World War, for example. My father was in Second World War, my mother too, you know. All the films we see, catastrophic films, you don't even know the fears you make, you know, in your subconscious. They all came out. Like, you know, I was imagining things happening to my family, which I saw in the films, which I heard about. But But really, I was afraid of personal violence, of personal kind of stuff, you know, that somebody will come up to my daughter and rape her, for example. There was no trace of something happening of that kind, because we had great solidarity among, you know, Belgrade, among people. Everybody was looking after each other, you know. But this was kind of a picture of violence I was afraid of, you know.
Well, in talking about the solidarity, though, mm-hmm. was Serbia divided, though, between the people who were for Milosevic and the people who were against
him? No, absolutely. This is one of the prejudices that I hear very often from. During the bombings, everybody was brought together by this survival struggle. And, you know, death makes you equal. I wish we could make in peace that kind of solidarity without the threat of death, you know, because if you are under threat of a bit of something above you, you know, money, class, and race melts, you know, the differences. Money cannot save you from a bomb, you know.
You know, earlier you were talking about how one of the common disputes you'd have with your daughter was whether she had to be home if the air raid sirens went off, mm-hmm. Because you wanted to make sure that if you died, you died together, but she preferred to die with her friends.
Yes. And she left me.
So would she come home when the sirens went off, or would she stay with
friends? I imposed on her. You uh-huh. know, it was really a very difficult decision for me to impose on her, you know, because I didn't want ever to impose something on her. But it's not that she was safer with me than with her friend, you know. We had no really clues to what will be hit, you know, as collateral damage.
Right.
But I imposed on her, and she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I'm your mother, you know." I had no argument. I'm your mother, and, you know, you have to come back home. But at a certain point, I didn't impose on her anymore. I said, "You can stay wherever you want as long as you give me a phone call, and I know that you're inside," because we felt safer, like, inside and outside.
Right. God, what a really strange thing to have to experience. It's like, well, all the other mothers are letting their children die with their friends. You know?
Only few did it. I consider myself a feminist in that. Mothers would stick, you know, they were very, all families, you know, we had this kind of phrase, "Where are you spending the bombings tonight?" And the answer was, "In the circle of my family."
Were you always with somebody when the sirens went off?
I was very much afraid to stay alone, you know, and I also, when my husband left for a few days, he went away from Yugoslavia for a congress, and he even came back after 3 days, I invited my friends to sleep with me, because I was afraid to sleep only with my children, you know. But usually people spend bombings in the circle of their families, like a Christmas party, you know, like you choose circle your family. But I extended it. I had an extended family. I wanted it to be a circle of my friends. So we're like in 10-15, we had this big place, a big house, and we spent in 10-15 every evening from 8 to 4 a.m. That was usually the air raid time, you know, sitting together with dogs, with children, and trying to, you know, watch the missiles, and we had a good terrace so we could see them and talk about it as if it were stars, you know.
Jasmina Tishanovic is a novelist who lives in Belgrade. Her new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot, is her account of life just before and during the NATO bombing of Serbia. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacourt Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, new from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on life in Belgrade during and after the NATO bombing of Serbia. We continue our talk with Serbian writer Jasmina Tishanovic. And as the contested presidential election continues to play out in the courts, linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the language of the law. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Serbian novelist Jasmina Tešanović. Her diary of her daily life in Belgrade just before and during the NATO bombing has just been published in the new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot. She co-founded Serbia's first feminist press. I think a lot of people who weren't in Serbia, like people here in America, were wondering, well, how do the Serbs feel about everything that Milosevic has done with the Serb military, to the people in Kosovo, to the people in Bosnia? Could you talk about that a little bit? You opposed Milosevic. You obviously were not in favor of this. You co-edited a book that contained the writings of Bosnian refugees. But still, how did you deal with knowing that your government was responsible for these atrocities?
I think not a lot of people knew what was really going on. You have to bear in mind that the control of the media was absolute. You know, you had the TV pictures and, you know, broadcasts which was saying completely the opposite. And this went on for years, like the Albanian terrorists. I'm speaking now of the last war, let's say. You know, I can speak for all the, it goes for all the rest of the wars, for the Croatian war, for the Bosnian war. And, you know, the power of propaganda is great, you know. It's really enormous, you know, on your mind, on minds of common people. So I'm sure that most of the people really didn't know. They would hear it from hearsay, you know, from people who come from Bosnia. But I know, for example, my father, who comes from Herzegovina, he wouldn't believe it. For many years, he didn't believe what he was hearing, you know, if he heard the opposite from what for him was possible. You know, only when he heard from his town a person he believed that they were really, that the Serbs were killing Muslims, he said, "Our Muslims? The Muslims we protected in the Second World War from the Nazis?" And they said, "Yes, they put them in a concentration camp." And then he got all red and he really had a heart attack after that. You know, that was his identity of a partisan, of a Serb, of a proper man, of an honest man, you know. And this was really, it broke his heart. In a way, I always had this feeling that maybe we should have done more, we should have done better, we should have been braver, you know. You know, I believe in a collective guilt, not as an objective guilt, but as something which does have a strong hold on people who are part of a community or of a leader, of an army, which does the stuff. I think we need some kind of healing process, of some kind of taking part in our history actively, saying we were idiots, we were manipulated. If we are not guilty, if you're guilty, you have to stand a trial, you know. But if you're not guilty directly, like if you don't have dirty hands, you know, if you are not a killer, still you have to go through this process of acknowledging what your president or your police did.
What about neighbors and people who you knew who were strong supporters of Milosevic? What was it like to interact with them, knowing his policies and what he was responsible for?
You know, it was very difficult to engage a proper conversation because there were my neighbor, for example, who voted or whom I supposed to have voted for Milosevic. I found out that actually they didn't vote for Milosevic. They were afraid of saying they didn't vote for Milosevic, you know.
They were afraid they'd be punished.
Oh, they're afraid they would be punished, they would lose their jobs. You know, people were living on very small money under very big pressure of losing even that money, which could cover like bread and water, you know, elementary stuff. But even if you would engage in some kind of conversation, you would get only those stupid things you would hear on TV, you know. It wasn't us Serbs first, it was them first. We are persecuted for centuries. You know, our graves are in Kosovo. We have to defend our graves. You know, all that stuff which has to be deconstructed, you know, it needs time to deconstruct that kind of manipulative construction of political victimization, which was exactly what Milosevic was doing, you know, because he made this position that Serbs are never guilty. They were always, you know, the biggest people in Balkans, but they were persecuted by all other nations. And that's a difficult issue to deconstruct.
You say in your journal that some of your women friends ended up volunteering to work for various humanitarian groups during the bombing. But for you, what you had to do was write. I mean, that's the way you were able to get through this. What did writing do to help you endure the bombing?
It helped me to stay mentally sane, you know, because after you would go through an experience of a day in Belgrade, you know, like ridiculous stuff, like, you know, speaking to my daughter, where should we get killed, you know, when I sat down and wrote all of that, I would see, you know, the difference between normal life in peace and the life we're living is normal now in war. Because the problem with wars is that they're boring, not that they're exciting, you know, they're terribly boring. You just have one single life. We all live the same time every day, you know, but it's not a life at all. It's some kind of culture of death you're living every day, you know. And by writing it down, I had this feeling of staying on the side of life, on the side of peace, you know. And also I had this feeling that if something happens to us, to me, you know, somebody maybe one day will find my diary and we'll see what really went on the ground. Because, you know, all this information we had on TVs, you know, I was watching BBC all the time, Sky News, which were the best, and CNN, you know. And they were good, but, you know, still we were invisible. Our lives were invisible. Never really mentioned a life of a you know, person from Belgrade. I must insist on that because I don't want to hurt people from Bosnia. It wasn't that bad. We had everything all the time. It was only the fear that was great and this impossible situation of fighting against the whole world. You know, it was something not manageable. You know, it was like really a death drive if you fight against the whole world, you know, and you had to put up with this feeling that eventually if you go on, you will be killed.
Now, at the same time you were writing your journal, you were also recording what was happening around you on film.
Yes. A woman who read a producer, producer.
Yeah.
A woman producer from German TV, national TV. She read my diary on the internet and she liked it very much. And she phoned me and asked me to film it. She wanted me to be all the time in speaking and doing, you know, living my life and to direct it. And I thought it was quite impossible to do it all the time, to do it by myself. So I asked the director to do it. And I must say that my family thought that I'm pretty crazy to accept to do it. And it's some kind of cynical attitude toward what was going on, you know, to film it at the same time it was going on. But then I said, you know, I am an artist, I'm a filmmaker, and being an artist is something about exhibiting your life, you know, it's some kind of not a very decent profession. There is something not decent about being a writer, an artist.
So, something exhibitionist?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the exhibitionist part won over my shy part of being a personal person, you know,
yes,
with a family. And my family was very much against it, and they didn't want to participate in my project. And the people on the streets were also against it. They didn't let us film their pain, the tragedy, you know, and they were right about it. We had, like, people who didn't want us to film them, and we had the military police after us because it was prohibited to film anything, you know, during the war, martial law. So my film is like only me explaining what's going on, you know? And the sound, because it's the only documentary film really filmed during the bombing. So it's a document, and as such, I think it's very precious, but everything is out of the picture, you know, you have it somewhere behind saying, oh, here is the bomb, you know, here it, boom, you know. And the other side, yeah, here are the people queuing, but they really don't want us to film them, you know. So it's a very strange film. It's very conceptual, I think.
My guest is Serbian novelist Jasmina Tešanović. Her journal of life just before and during the NATO bombing of Serbia is published in the new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Jasmina Tešanović. She is a Serbian writer who has written several novels, translated a lot of work. During the bombing of Belgrade, she kept a journal. That journal was emailed to a friend who put it on the internet. It kind of traveled around the world on the internet. Now it's actually been published in book form. It's called The Diary of a Political Idiot, Normal Life in Belgrade. I want to get back to your daughter. Okay. You write, and this is, you say, my daughter seems to be about 5 years older than when the bombing started. She seems older than me and treats me as if she is. I've lost her. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, absolutely. I have lost her as a child. And that's exactly when I wrote it. I didn't even know I was writing it so properly, you know, at that time. She stopped being a child during the bombings. You know, maybe it would have come anyway. You know, because she was like 15, and usually girls are 15 get away. But it was some kind of spur to, you know. And she came back as a grown woman now. You know, she's like very, as I said, very protective towards me, very independent. Now, for example, now she's alone in Belgrade because I'm here in the United States with my husband. And, you know, she's alone. She's taking care of her old grandfather. And I don't really worry about her anymore, you know. And
because she's so self-sufficient.
She's self-sufficient.
There's a new president of Yugoslavia, Kostunica. Any thoughts about him?
I'm pretty happy with him. You know, all of us want, you know, think that your president, especially after you had Milosevic for 10 years, should be a prince on a white horse, you know, because he did come up like that saving us, you know. And so everybody expects a perfect person, you know, and I stopped expecting a perfect person. You know, I'm happy that he's a democratic person, that he's educated, and that he's trying really hard to bring back Yugoslavia to normal life, you know. And everything the rest is something that we have to do, you know. It's a free space, and we have to, we people from Yugoslavia, we have to fill it in with our contents. For example, you know, women are not empowering Yugoslavia at all. They're completely invisible. So we have to fight for that, you know. We have to fight to change the laws. We have to fight, you know, we have to work. There's a lot of work to be done, you know, with this kind of president who is inclusive president, who doesn't want, you know, to go against anybody because he pursues just his own politics of his own party, but he likes somebody who wants to be president of all citizens. In this sense, he's a good president, I think.
What's your neighborhood like now? Is it has normal life resumed?
Oh, we sleep again, and it's much livelier. Actually, it's slower. You know, it's slower, but it's you have relaxed faces. You know, people are not complaining. People are not tense. We have prices going up because we have the free market now. You know, this is some kind of interregnum political period. You know. We have no laws, no true government. It's some kind of controlled anarchy. And prices are going up. We don't have electricity. We're paying now for all the misdeeds that Milosevic did and hid them under the carpet, you know. And I'm always worried, how long will these people, you know, resist all this kind of not having, you know, enough to eat or heat, you know, because I'm better off, you know, I'm not that bad, you know. But I hear in the, like, among common people in the market, they never complained. They said, if we made it through all these years, we will make it another year or two. Of course, they need help. And I'm really appealing all the time for humanitarian aid, like medicines, heating, you know, nothing special, just to make them feel human after all this. Then they can vote better, you know. It's difficult to expect intellectual conscience and if you are hungry. It's really nearly impossible.
Your book, The Diary of a Political Idiot, about your life in Belgrade during the bombing, has been published in the United States. It started off as just your journal. You emailed it to a friend. She put it on the internet. It spread all around. But your name was taken off so that you couldn't be... So it's not to incriminate you because you were saying things against the Milosevic government in these diaries. So you became famous for something that was anonymous. It must have been a funny sensation.
Well, it's, you know, it's one of those stories I always teach at Women's Studies because I have this course of creative writing of women, for women, of women, you know. And I look back at history and, you know, all the women were always invisible in their doings, you know, and especially their writers, you know. You have so many, like Hypatia, you know, we don't even have her writings. We only hear of her through other men's writings, you know. And when it happened to me, I, in a way, I always wanted to be invisible because I had a feeling that I can be freer if I'm invisible. So I always used other names before, you know. I used to use men's names in order to be free to publish, you know, free to speak out also, you know. It's some kind of interior censorship I used. And when they took my name off and I became the anonymous woman from Belgrade writing, I felt it was okay, you know, it was right. When I wanted my name back, because it was because of protection. I wanted my name to protect me, my work to protect me. It was when the journalist was killed in Belgrade, and I had a feeling that only publicity will protect me. On the contrary to what they really did, I think, you know, often publicity does protect you.
Now, I want to get back briefly to the day that Milosevic was overthrown. You were at the parliament building that day. What brought you there? What did you expect was going to happen that day?
Well, we were hoping for many years that it will happen. You know, it's ever since 1996, we had those huge demonstrations of half a million people for 3 months demonstrating, you know. And ever since 1996, we knew that it was possible, you know, that that people were against Milosevic, you know. And that was the day that I think it was a collective feeling. We had a feeling that if we don't do it today, somehow, you know, we will be done for another 10 years at least, if not forever, you know. And we didn't know, you know, what actually we found out later on was that it was very organized by the opposition. You know, they had already contacts with military police. They had contacts with the army. So they knew that there were great possibilities that the army and the police won't intervene against the people. But people didn't know that. People just had this feeling of strength if you are in many and if you're together. And if you stay together and in many, and if you don't move, they will try to kill, and they will kill a lot, probably. But they cannot kill everybody. They cannot kill 1 million people, you know? And this is exactly one of the leaders had it in the one free radio we had, which was really impossible to hear. You could hear it and hear it not, you know, very often. He said that, and it was like some kind of message. Go out and just do it, you know. I remember the first gas, lacrimogenous gas, it came out, you know, tear gas. And I said, okay, Yasmina, now you cannot breathe, but you will breathe. You know, it was some kind of, you know, you get this adrenaline stuff, you know, you're different, you know. And I started breathing all of a sudden because it was a decision to breathe. But I said to myself, and everybody was doing the same, I'm just some kind of collective voice, until they enter the parliament, we won't move. And we did it, you know. So I said, okay, now I can behave normally. I think it's over, you know. Then I decided to go home, and then we encountered military tanks, and we were looking at the soldiers, and the soldiers are looking back at us. And at a certain point, the soldiers waved at us friendly, and we waved back. And that was it. Of course, it was very dangerous another 24 hours because Milosevic was trying badly to give orders of killing, but it seems that the generals didn't want to obey him. It's still a history to write, you know. I'm just speaking from somebody who knows a little bit from inside, but actually I'm just a woman from the streets, you know.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences and thoughts with us, and I wish you the best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yasmina Tashanovic is a novelist who lives in Belgrade. Her new book, The Diary of a Political Idiot, is her account of life just before and during the NATO bombing of Serbia. Thank you. Coming up, as the contested election makes its way through the courts, our linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on legalese. This is Fresh Air. The broadcasts of the legal proceedings surrounding the Florida vote are exposing us to some confusing legal language. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts about legalese.
When the Florida Supreme Court ruled that the Secretary of State had to provide more time for hand recounts, George W. Bush was quick to react. The court had rewritten the law, he said, and cloaked its ruling in legalistic language. That last bit might have raised a few eyebrows. In the circumstances, it was a little like criticizing the Pope for cloaking his encyclicals in Latin. But no politician ever went far wrong taking on lawyers in their language, and nowhere more so than in modern America. In a curious way, it's a reflection of the obsessive interest we have in our legal institutions. Take the Italians, for example. They don't tell lawyer jokes the way we do, but then they don't make media stars out of people like Judge Judy or Johnny Cochran, or devote a whole TV channel to running nothing but court proceedings in numbing detail. And in the end, they don't have the kind of trust in their legal system that Americans do, or spend nearly as much time litigating their disagreements. In Italy, taking somebody to court is a fool's errand. That paradoxical attitude about the law carries over to the way we think about its language. Of course, there's plenty to make fun of. Legal language is like one of those dialects they're supposed to speak in remote Appalachian hollows. It's a kind of para-English that branched off from the main shoot of the language in the late Middle Ages and has set up an independent existence. Now it lives in respectable secession from the reality that the rest of us inhabit. To be sure, lawyers are aware that this is a problem, and in recent years there have been efforts to rewrite statutes and consumer documents in language that people can understand. Even the Supreme Court has toned down some of its more baroque linguistic effects. The legal scholar Peter Tiersma noted that over the decades there's been a consistent decline in the court's use of words like hereunto and aforesaid in its opinions. Still, it isn't likely that lawyers are ever going to wind up speaking just like the rest of us. Part of this is just economic self-interest. As Tiersma observes, lawyers feel more comfortable about billing their clients $250 an hour for advising them of something than for simply telling them about it. The main reason why lawyers cling to their language, though, is that they like to think it's more precise than ordinary English. But actually, a growing number of legal scholars have begun to question that point. And after sitting through the OJ trial, the impeachment proceedings, and now all the Florida election cases, you'd think that the general public would have begun to have some doubts about the precision of legal language as well. Does anybody still think that lawyers have a clearer hold on the meaning of their word discretion than we do on the meaning of ours? Sometimes, in fact, the language of the law is more obscure and ambiguous than anything that everyday English has to offer. Take the simple word shall that appeared in that crucial Florida statute about when the Secretary of State was supposed to certify the results. It's one of the most bizarre turns of the whole affair that the election of an American president might depend on the interpretation of a word that closed its run as a productive element of American speech around 1916, the year that Henry James died. But lawyers keep inserting shall into contracts and statutes as if the imperatives of law were too sacrosanct to be rendered by a verb that ordinary people still use. It isn't as if shall is more precise than the other words. In fact, Black's Law Dictionary says that the word can mean must or may or will or should, depending on the context. And right now, there are lawyers lined up three deep behind each of those interpretations, all because the Florida legislature wouldn't stoop to writing a statute that began, "The Secretary of State has to." In Australia, they've taken the step of banishing the word shall from their statutes, but I don't know if that move would have much support here. As one legal scholar put it, shall is a totem that serves to conjure up the flavor of the law. And the public has its own reasons for wanting to keep legal language separate from the hurly-burly of ordinary usage, the same way we want the courts to be above the partisan fray. That was doubtless what was going through the minds of the Florida legislators as they debated what their role in the drama should be. They kept talking about the need to bring conclusivity to the process. That has only a tenuous claim to being a word. You won't find it in either the OED or Black's Law Dictionary. It does pop up occasionally in statutes as a pretentious substitute for conclusiveness, but that wasn't how the Florida legislators were using it. What they really meant to say was something like, we have to bring finality to the process, or what people nowadays like to describe as closure. But they wanted to invest the notion with a feeling of legal certainty, and the word conclusivity had the sound of an incantation that will lay everybody's doubts to rest. And in a sense, they're right. The whole business has gone the way protracted legal proceedings always do. Palm Beach, Miami-Dade, Seminole, postmarks, chads, and dimples, things have gotten so messy and complicated that nobody thinks it's still possible to determine who actually got the most votes. What matters is who carries the day in court. In the end, win is a legal term, too.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from HarperCollins Children's Books and Joanna Kotler Books, publishers of Penelope Jane, A Fairy Tale, a picture book and CD package by Roseanne Cash. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Medicine on Mount Everest. Kenneth Kamler has made several expeditions as a team doctor. He's dealt with severe frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness, and treated survivors of the storm in 1996. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.